My name's Count Faulkner, and the date's February 8th, and I'm in the home of Colonel Whiteman. And, first of all, Colonel Whiteman, when were you born and whereabouts were you born?
Well, I was born in 1904 in England, and came to Canada in 1912, and settled in Calgary. Later than that time, the First World War was declared, and my father went overseas with the 103rd and served overseas, got wounded, and was sent home and came back. And then we moved to Victoria in 1917. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the First World War, we had a depression, as we call it then, probably today you might call it a recession. It certainly wasn't as bad as 1929 to 30s. And it was hard to get work. I went to George J. School and started off in high school, and then I found that things were pretty tough at home, so I went to work in the radio business, in a radio broadcasting company here called Western Canada Radio.
How old would you be then?
I would probably be 15.
Mm-hmm.
16 years old, and I worked with them building radio sets. Old Super Heterodyne format, which is a push-pull audio radio. Of course, don't forget, in those days TV wasn't invented. And then I became a broadcaster and stayed with them until about 1926. When I left to join the Daily Colonist newspaper. At the same time, I should mention that in 1924, I joined the Canadian Scottish Regiment as a rugby player.
Mm-hmm.
And we had such characters playing with us in those days as the late Brigadier F.N. Cavalier, who was Colonel on D-Day. I was his second in command on D-Day of the battalion, and Bobby Tye, who has since passed away, and Jack Bryden, who got killed on D-Day plus one, and we were all sort of a team, and eventually I joined the regiment as a private. Became a corporal, and then became an officer, and got my commission in 1928,
mm-hmm.
which was signed by a gentleman called Lord Wellington, which is quite an interesting, because he was a great man, and of course he passed away many years ago. Well, having become a subaltern, or in those days we had a little different situation than they have today, we were called either a second lieutenant or a provisional lieutenant, one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And after a year, providing you had stood up to your requirements,
mm-hmm.
having passed your exam to become a lieutenant, confirmed as a lieutenant. So from there on in, I in my business world, I was in the columns, as I already stated, and eventually I became advertising manager worked up to the rank of captain, and eventually in 1938, I'm pretty sure it was 1938, excuse me, I became a major. In the meantime, the regiment was commanded by a colonel called Don Martin, a very fine man, who had succeeded Colonel Urquhart, Sandy Urquhart. Don Martin, the normal time for a commanding officer in any regiment is 3 years and can be extended to four. And that's the end of his term, like any other situation. Get in business, you're on a board of directors for 3 to 4 years, and after that you have to resign so that newer people come on, which is quite right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Colonel Don Martin decided that he would form a second battalion up the island. He said, we will cover the island with the kilt. And he did just this. So we had two battalions, one up the island, headquarters in Nanaimo, company in Alberni, Port Alberni, Courtney, Comox, Duncan, Nanaimo. And we were friendly rivals, and headquarters, of course, was in Victoria. And then in 1939, when things were getting seriously, I got called out to the office. If I can remember correctly, I would say it was about the 1st of September to recruit new recruits for the unit, because mm-hmm. it was obviously that the war clouds were forming, and this was just after Hitler, as you know, had gone into Poland. But we were still undecided whether anything would happen. And if you recall, Neville Chamberlain, who
mm-hmm.
went to visit the Fuhrer and came back and said he had his guarantee there'd be no war. However, the war came along, as you know. And we had two battalions. Well, then the problem occurred in the early 40s. We had two battalions, and all that was required to go overseas was one battalion. So in effect, we had two lieutenant colonels, names if you want, but two lieutenant colonels. We had 10 majors. We had something like 20 captains and 40 subalterns. And each one of those ranks had to be cut in half. In other words, one lieutenant colonel, seven majors, and so many captains and lieutenants. So the time came to form the one battalion, and I was already a qualified major. Said, well, now if you want to go overseas, you'll have to revert to the rank of captain, which I did,
mm-hmm.
Along with many others. Others decided not to, so they stayed home. And we had two lieutenant colonels, which ended up being one. It was quite an interesting. I just want to cut. Can you cut that just a minute? I just want to cough, yeah. Okay, go ahead. Is it on now?
Yeah, it's fine. All right. If I could just go back a bit, maybe. Did you ever have any cadet training in school? Mm-hmm. Or
no.
Nothing?
No.
So the original reason for joining the...
Well, the original reason, there were two reasons for joining. One was my father was in the First World War. That I thought, well, long before I thought of the Second War, and of course,
mm-hmm.
1920. But I wanted to play rugby, and I decided to play for the Canadian Scottish Regiment.
They had quite a good team.
Oh, we had a good team. We were champions for many years.
Yeah.
We had a good team, and I enjoyed it. And my reasons probably for joining would be just because I wanted to play for the Canadian Scottish. I really didn't. At that time, I wasn't what you'd say military-minded, if you know what I mean. I just decided it was a good thing to do, and I enjoyed playing for them, and I played, and I eventually became their coach for many years because I got, I broke a collarbone, and in those days there was no insurance, and if you have a wife and family, you couldn't afford to be off work too long.
Mm-hmm.
Collarbone won't keep you off work, but if you broke a leg, you could be off for 6 weeks or so, whatever. So that was the reason perhaps I joined them. I don't know any other reason, but once I had got in there and became an officer, the affiliation and the fellowship and the esprit de corps over the last 50 years has been indescribable, because it was just a fellowship organization. And you must realize this too, and I'm sure you do, but when you get out in the front line and you know you have your pals around you, it's a great concern to you that they're still there when the battle's over, and you're still there, and you know that they've never let you down.
Mm-hmm.
It's something you can't buy. But that was later on. So that's roughly in my early days with the Canadian Scottish Regiment.
Mm-hmm. So you received your commission in 1928?
Yes.
And what did you do right after then? What was your main duty for the regiment?
As a soldier?
Yeah.
Well, I was a platoon commander.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, in those days, the establishment were four platoons to a company. In those days,
mm-hmm.
And we used to have a command which you might not be familiar with, but it's called Form 4s. In 1939, that all went out, and it became three platoons to accompany your Form 3s.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it had been modified considerably, and perhaps in those days, quite rightly so, it's more modernized,
mm-hmm.
than it was previously. And of course today, in 1983, there isn't much use asking me about the establishment or how they worked, because it's entirely different. We didn't have, in those days, we didn't have electronics, we didn't have anything, we didn't have any nuclear, we didn't have guided missiles, we didn't have anything.
Mm-hmm.
We were a vast improvement on World War I, but today, no doubt they'd call us pretty antiquated.
Right.
But this is progress, it just changes.
Mm-hmm. But it was hard times as far as funding. And
well, of course, when you get your pay cut right down because of the recession, which you know about now today in 83, that if you're married with a family and you got to buy your uniform and spend two nights a week down there, you know, we didn't have cars, had to go in a streetcar.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a change from the day. So we did it the hard way.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's the best way, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. And that was your responsibility to buy your own uniform.
Oh, we had to. No one. Even at the start of World War II, we had to buy our own. In those days, there were pistols and old binoculars. We had to buy our own. And then they went into the automatic, which the pistols were thrown out. But we had to buy everything ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And recruitment was a large priority to the regiment then. What role did you play in that? Or
well, what year are we
speaking
of? Say 1929.
Oh, 29?
28, 29, that thing.
I don't think any particular thing could be said except one thing. Colonel Don Martin, whom I've mentioned before, who was the colonel, we were playing for the rugby, we became officers, as I've already stated. He said, now you're all subalterns, I want you to bring in 6 recruits each.
Mm-hmm.
Which I say most of us didn't.
Mm-hmm.
We had a good strength. Because there's a lot of things you have to realize. You get a very high strength when you have unemployment.
Right.
And it probably tapered down, pretty hard to remember, about 1936, 37, and 38, because we were then, just like we were in 1981, everybody was looking, everybody you know, couldn't care less. And then as soon as the war started, we built up very rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
But we were averaging a strength, and I'm sure of this, of about 400,
mm-hmm.
all ranks, before the Second World War.
Mm-hmm. So these people that you brought in, they'd just be your friends and your buddies?
Privates, and then eventually most of them, I wouldn't say most of them, but many of them became officers or NCOs.
Uh-huh.
And this helped build the battalion up, and because when you get a second battalion, when you get another 32 officers, you see everybody brings in 6, so you know, that's quite a lot of people.
Right. How about when the Royal Scots sort of allied with you?
Well, they allied with us in 1928, if I remember correctly. And because the Royal Scots are our sister unit, know.
Mm-hmm.
And while we're the Canadian Scottish Regiment are Highlanders, the Royal Scots are Lowlanders, and they wear trews rather than a kilt.
Mm-hmm.
But we still carried our kilt, and then about, pretty hard to remember, about 19, you can check this figure somewhere, about 1930. Princess Mary became our colonel in chief.
Right.
I would say about 1930. It's a long way back for me to try and remember. And she remained our colonel in chief until she passed away in 65,
mm-hmm.
around there. And then, and just recently, as you know, we 3 years ago, we got Princess Alexandra,
mm-hmm.
to be our colonel in chief, and she paid us a visit up into Victoria here at that time,
mm-hmm.
which was May 1981.
Mm-hmm. Did this alliance with the Royal Scots, did that have any effect? I mean, did it change anything for morale-wise? Or
for the other ranks, I would say it didn't mean a thing,
mm-hmm.
of any consequence. For non-commissioned officers, warrant officers, and officers, it meant a lot.
Yeah.
But for other ranks, no, not really, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't mean anything to me, mm-hmm. I would say. Now, at that particular stage of the game, we wore the Mackenzie tartan, the kilt tartan, and the trews. And when we joined the Royal Scots, we changed from that to the hunting steward,
right.
which we now wear. And of course, that's additional cost. Because as a field officer, and a major in those days, I wore tartan riding briefs with the high boots. So you had to pull it out and buy another set of riding briefs,
mm-hmm.
which you don't buy for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
At any time. Those days of these days.
So during this period, like late 20s,
mm-hmm.
up until the mid-30s, how often would the regiment get together for training or parading?
We paraded twice a week.
Twice a week?
And one night a week, this is nighttime, when I say twice a week, at
one night a week for rugby practice.
Mm-hmm.
So we put in a pretty cool time.
Mm-hmm.
Because after three nights a week out of seven, and if we were married and bringing up a family, we didn't get to have my time at home. And then, of course, in those days, you have to realize something which you probably wouldn't have thought of. We worked in the offices, anywhere else, 6 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
Then it went to five and a half. And we got 1 week's holiday, and that had to be spent at camp, whether you were a private or an officer or whatever, and you got paid.
Mm-hmm.
And I really can't tell you, I don't even remember what we got paid.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty hard to go back 50 years and remember what
right.
we got.
But this training that you've had, say, once a week, what would that entail?
Well, as far as the troops were concerned, you were out on parade and you did MMG training, machine gun training, Bren gun training, unarmed combat, and out on heels range, shooting, and weekend schemes, bivouac, and tactical movements mm-hmm. all the time. And then as far as the officers were concerned, if you were a P lieutenant, provisional lieutenant or a second lieutenant, you had to take courses to qualify to be a captain. And in addition to what you were already doing, that took about 4 months, three nights a week. So in other words, you were down there six nights a week. And then you qualified to a captain, and then you did the field tactics for the final qualifications on all courses and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So you spent a lot of time.
Mm-hmm. No, the weapons that you used to train with, I guess, were pretty old and outdated.
Today they are antiquated, but with the Lee Enfield rifle, which we used in this war,
mm-hmm.
Second World War, and we had the old Lewis gun, which you might have heard about,
mm-hmm.
Which of course is now antiquated. We went into the Bren, and various other things, and the Piat and all these things we had in this war, they were never thought of.
Mm-hmm.
So we trained on the old weapons, but that was good. Now the Canadian Scottish Regiment was called out to do guard duty in 1939 when the war started. We had a company at Mary Hill. If you're not too familiar where that is, that's Mary Hill is out by Race Rocks, Williams Head.
Mm-hmm.
And the big guns there,
mm-hmm.
capable of going 16 miles. And we had one at Albert Head, which is where I was, and another one at the Joint Magazine, which you know where that is, 6 Mile House. The ammunition dump, of course, is still there, and you've probably seen the vents coming up the ground when you drive out to the spit. And then we also guarded the airport,
mm-hmm.
which the present airport in Victoria, which at that time wasn't even built.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, and I left Albert Head and went to the airport, and we had four or five Northwest Delta planes, Lysanders, and Grumman Goose, two of them. And it was the start of the RCAF. But they were very minimized, and we just did the guard duty, patrol the whole area.
Mm-hmm. How about these summer camps that were held? When was the first one?
The first one that I remember?
Yeah.
Well, I guess it was 1920. And Beacon Hill Park.
Uh-huh. But I mean, there was the ones when you went up to Maple Bay.
Maple Bay, that was when I was an officer. That would be, Maple Bay would be about 1932.
Mm-hmm.
We went up in the local destroyers from here. Yes, that would be about 32.
So that was the first of that kind of...
Well, as far as I, as an officer, yes. But we had it in Beacon Hill Park. big concentration, and the camp is now, if you know in your mind, it's called Haywood's soccer field, I think. It's on Haywood Avenue on Beacon Hill.
Mm-hmm.
You know where that is.
Right.
And then we went to Maple Bay, of course, and did good schemes, tactical schemes.
When you went to Maple Bay, say just pick one of your one of your summer camps. What would that sort of include? There was one time that I read about that you had a mock attack on the beach. Were you present there?
Oh yeah. The destroyers came in. Yeah, we used smoke and everything else.
Yeah,
simulated. Yeah.
So this is kind of a big experience for.
Well, it certainly was, while I'm sure it was reasonably successful, it was just the first time, and you had to learn a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was that we were defending, and they came in. As far as I was concerned, I was on the defending side now.
Mm-hmm.
They learned as much as we did, I'm sure, but of course when World War II came on, the other way, we were landing and they were defending the Germans. We learned a lot. Oh yeah, and we slept out in the open,
mm-hmm.
a couple of blankets.
Certainly was practical value in the long run.
Oh yeah. Well, you see, don't forget that we were all pretty well young fellows and didn't make much difference sleeping out in one blanket and a ground sheet and rain or whatever didn't make much difference. But
mm-hmm.
I certainly couldn't do it today.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't even try. My age would be ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. And I guess right around then the 2nd Battalion was formed. And
now, the 2nd Battalion was already with us up in the
Oh, they were.
Yeah.
So you got to meet them for the first time.
Well, pretty well. We worked together. They had their own show at Nanaimo. We had a concentration once a year of both battalions.
Uh-huh.
And they originally started off the 2nd Battalion as an MMG battalion, and later became infantry. MMG is machine gun,
mm-hmm.
Which were the old Vickers. They consisted of people from, Duncan, Nanaimo, the Albanese, and Comox, and Salt Spring Island.
Mm-hmm. There was a bit of
rivalry.
Rivalry. I wasn't going to say rivalry. I was actually thinking of recruiting the boundaries.
Went up as far as we didn't go any further than Goldstream as far as Victoria was concerned. There wasn't that much rivalry at all. That we were. Both friends. No, there was no taking people, because you see, you must realize if you're going to join the unit, and you lived in Duncan and you joined the Scottish, that would be rather ridiculous. You have to drive down to Victoria 3 nights a week and back. That just didn't add
yeah.
up.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly when you had to pay for your own gas. Although gas in those days was 15 cents a gallon, I know. But nevertheless, it wasn't practical. So no, there was no stealing of any one person from one area, or the boundaries were restricted, but we knew our own. We just handled Greater Victoria, which was Langford Lake and City.
Mm-hmm.
Salt Spring Island had their own, and Duncan, and I'm on shore.
Hmm. And you went to Sydney in 37. Got a bit of training as far as chemical warfare goes.
Mm-hmm.
What does that include?
Well, the chemical warfare in those days was mostly what we were concerned with in those days was the only history we had from the First World War is gas.
Mm-hmm.
And we trained in gas respirators and used the various detectors, litmus paper and so on and everything else to detect gas and so on. But it was hardly, it's quite true, it was called a chemical war, training, but not really as we know it
could
be today. you must remember that things like the nuclear, and, 1928, the atom hadn't even been split. I mean, which started the nuclear, as you know. They had the missing atom for so long, and they finally spread it, and that started the whole thing. But we were not a, well, I was going to say, not a barbaric defense anywhere in the world, but we weren't modernized to where we are today. It just hadn't been thought of, hadn't been invented. I mean, it's hard for you to realize, but half the people in 1928 never had a telephone. No one had a refrigerator. They weren't invented. You never had an electric stove, never heard of the things. I know, it's pretty hard for you to realize this, but so actually I'm very lucky I've come to the, if you want to call it, the primitive stage of the modern world. Up until the Second World War, which was very far advanced from the First World War, up until the day, which is far beyond me, with the missiles and nuclear and all these things, which I know nothing about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, anybody told me in 1920 you're going to the moon, I'd say you're crazy. I'd have your head examined.
Mm. So the mood in the regiment during the early 30s, I mean, people really didn't expect a war. So during those early days of the Depression, what would be the main reason for the average guy off the street to join up?
Well, there's a lot of things you don't realize. In 1928, I would doubt in Victoria if 10% people had a radio. So, what did you do at night?
Mm-hmm.
Now, sure, and my hobby, actually, was, you can see these are all mine, hunting and pictures and fishing. But hundreds, thousands weren't interested in that, and I understand it, because everybody liked the same thing, we'd have a hell of a time. So why not join the regiment, go down and get some fellowship?
Mm-hmm.
Because after a rugby practice, for example, we'd go out to the Bucket of Blood, beer parlor in the Squamish in those days, and have half a dozen beers. And had a fellowship, because the esprit de corps is something that you can't buy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't come in off the street and say, well, I'm a member of your gang, if you want to call it a gang. But you have to learn to live with them and play rugby with them and take the bumps and everything else. Then you become a great part of the family, and this made a great esprit de corps feeling for the unit. Who every time we played and we won, they thought we were good. That's neither here nor there, but it certainly helped the feeling of the unit when you went to war. Because you had a fellowship that you can't buy. I mean, this is probably hard for you to understand. I don't think it's hard for you to understand, but you've never experienced it that way.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, these guys are your friends?
All of them. Sure. Sure.
So, I mean, just throughout the day, I mean,
well, you know, I'd meet them and see them downtown. Victoria in those days was a population of 60,000, now 250,000. But in those days, I knew hundreds of people. Now I don't know anyone. Well, where the population's grown, I mean, hundreds and hundreds, the same as Vancouver. Where you live, it's just grown up, and that's the way it is.
How about the community there? How do they look upon the regiment?
Oh, very favorably.
Yeah.
We were we are the only militia infantry battalion on Vancouver Island.
Mm-hmm.
I always have been. Now, there's always been the 5th, which is the 5th Canadian Royal Artillery. But their artillery, they handle the big guns. That's their job. We're the only infantry battalion on the whole island.
So you were there at every parade with the band?
Oh, yeah. Every 24th of May, we had big pipe band, and we were very popular. There was absolutely no kidding about that. There was no question of it. And we wore the kilt and didn't have any trouble with hoodlums, so to speak, and as it might have today. those days, and if there were, we certainly fatten them in a hurry, but...
Within the community, you mean?
Yeah. It was a peaceful town compared to today. It's, you know, when you go back to 1930s, you're talking about now, probably 6 to 10,000 cars in the whole of Victoria. Now there's 150,000 cars. No, it's just the way it was. In my early days, I didn't have a car. I went to work on a bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
No one would go to work on a bicycle today unless they had a head exam.
So,
is it that I'm going to get another drink?
Yeah. Okay, you were involved with the media throughout these years, and I was just wondering, in, say, 38, 39, what were your views on the world situation? Could you sort of see something boiling down the road?
Yes, I think very definitely. It was obvious in 1938, in particular, it became almost a sure thing that we were going to have an uprising, at least in Germany. Matter of fact, I made a bet with a fellow who's now dead, he was in the Air Force later, was Benny Bendron, that we'd have a war, and I lost it by 1 month. I was 1 month long on. But it was obviously, it was coming. And we had just got over the depression, as we called it then, and today they want to call it a recession. And we were just getting back on our feet. And it really was a very touchy situation. But in my opinion, I went out from my job in the Colonist 7 days before the war started to recruit for the Canadian Scottish Regiment.
Mm-hmm.
Down in an office on Government Street.
Mm-hmm.
It was obviously there, and as far as Canada was concerned, permanent force-wise, we were in pretty horrible shape,
mm-hmm.
And particularly the Air Force, the RCAF, and at the start of the war, as you might know, might not know, but many of them joined up with the RCAF. Only to be seconded and paid by the RAF, the British Air Force. And many of these people that I know of threw transports and planes over from Canada to Europe on RAF pay. And rations. Well, of course, we hadn't got over. I'm talking about Canadian Scottish. We hadn't got. We got over at that time. We didn't get over until 1941. Although we mobilized in September of 39. Now. Sure, you know all about this, but just in case you don't, to fill you in, we had a little bit of a problem as far as we were concerned because we had two battalions.
Mm-hmm.
We had the one in Victoria and we had one up the island with headquarters in Nanaimo. And we were both completely mobilized, full establishments for a year until it decided that only one battalion would go over, so we ended up with the two lieutenant colonels and 14 majors, and 20 captains, and about 30 subalterns, and we only needed half.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a matter you either had to revert to go overseas or stay with the 2nd Battalion in Victoria, headquarters in Victoria, which was going to be our reinforcement battalion. And of course, in the sorting out, many left because they're physically unfit. In those days, you had to be absolutely physically fit. In 1944, it was a little different story.
Mm-hmm.
But they wanted to take the best, and it's quite right. Physically fit, I mean, want to take the best. So we had that problem, but we ended up with one battalion, and we went overseas.
How did the regiment react to the declaration of war, the Victoria Regiment?
I think they were, I'm sure, as far as I'm concerned, no one was surprised. Not at all. No one was surprised.
What sort of changes took place within the regiment? I mean, recruiting was stepped up, I imagine.
Well, we had to get up to full strength. In any peacetime militia unit, you're governed by the amount of men you can have on strength,
mm-hmm.
because the government pays for the number that are on parade. And honestly, I can't remember what the strength was before the war, before the Second World War. Probably in the neighborhood of 400. Today in February 1983 is 275, because we're in a restraint program today. So we had to build up from approximately 400 to a full strength of 1,000,
mm-hmm.
while actually there's 1,100 in the Second World War Battalion. Today, the new battalion organization, I don't know how many are in it, it's all changed completely. We took over in the Second World War thinking that the First World War tactics were antique, and now these chaps today are sure that we were antiques. It's just a matter of progress. I mean, there's so many things you've got to realize. You didn't have any communications on electronics or anything like that in any way, shape, or form.
Mm.
Missiles weren't invented.
Mm-hmm.
There was none of this computerized modern world we live in, which you're so used to now. It's a little bit strange to me, but there was none of this.
Mm-hmm.
We were working in the old days with wireless.
Mm. Any problem getting these extra 600 men?
Oh no, we had hundreds we had to turn away that weren't physically fit.
Yeah.
Oh no. Because two things, the rank and file, didn't really have to have an education, if you follow me.
Mm-hmm.
They probably didn't have a job, that was one, and secondly, the young fellow particularly wanted the adventure. And there was absolutely no problem,
mm-hmm.
no problem whatsoever, in any way, shape, or form, no.
Sort of took the cream of the crop, I guess.
Well, we had to, they all had to have a medical, and many of them weren't accepted.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I would say, I wouldn't know what percentage, but I'd say many, many of them, 25% of them weren't accepted.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no problem.
How about accommodating them?
Well, when war started out, we accommodated them all, but they slept in the armies on the palliasses, which is a cover, a dig, mm-hmm. whatever you want to call it, stuffed with straw, and we fed them there. And then, I'm talking about the 1st Battalion, and then we went, we went out to Otter Point,
mm-hmm.
and moved into tents. Some buildings and had a proper camp. The same thing happened in Nanaimo.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't there for the Nanaimo, but for the 2nd Battalion, I couldn't tell you too much on how they fared out, but it was the same way.
Yeah.
The Nanaimo camp is still there, actually. And then, of course, later on, they, just about the time we left, they built the camp at Gordon Head, which is now part of your university.
Yeah.
And those old buildings are still there. And those buildings were used to train NCOs, and officers. And they came over to us as reinforcements or replacements if a man got sick or physically unfit for various reasons. He'd be sent home to Canada to do the home defense, and the new ones would come out from there. I'm talking about officers and officers, NCOs, which are non-commissioned officers, and officers. And that's where we got our replacements from. Mm-hmm. The men, there wasn't too much trouble. They came, we always got that, except when we got into Normandy, that was a different kettle of fish. But we sat in England, don't forget, from 41 to 44, and we trained. I must say, because of the time we spent there, we were very well trained. Because that's all they did all day long.
Yeah.
Tactical schemes and everything else, and new innovations that came in, and various other things that we had to learn. Actually, when prior to 1939, we used to, you probably never heard of it, we used to form up in fours, and there was you formed fours. Well, that went out in 1939.
Mm-hmm.
We went in threes. And you drilled in three ranks. You had three sections to a platoon, three platoons to a company. The old one was four. So we were starting to modernize, but it took a lot of experience and time before we became accustomed to it and pretty well organized.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as I think I mentioned to you before, but perhaps I didn't, by the time we were ready for D-Day, the First World War tactics and trench warfare was archaic to us. And if there is another war, then what we did in the Second World War will be exactly the same. But it's just progress. There's so many things that have happened since. I think the